It's hard for me to believe these many years later in the guilt I felt for the failure of days to come. The threads of those threads have lasted to this day. Guilt is often an excuse for not thinking, and maybe that's what happened to me. In any case, it was to be 2 years before I could write another play, The Little Foxes, and when I did get to it, I was so scared that I wrote it 9 times.
Your second play, Days to Come, which I liked when reading it in the collected plays, and the line I liked best was that things start out as hopes but end up as habits. Mm. I guess it hit something in me. But it sort of got me thinking to very early, big, huge successes that can't be followed up, and people are just sort of sunk into terrible depression about not being able to follow up their first super hit of some kind. And I further thought that you and Dashiell Hammett were sort of late starters in the field of writing. You didn't have your first success until you were 28. That was when you first wrote a play.
It's a late start to start writing, but I don't think even now it'd be considered a late start for success. There are very few writers that I know who have been successful very much earlier, maybe 25, 6, somewhere in there. But it's a... I don't think it's a very late age now. I don't know how old Dash was when he first... He certainly wasn't very young when he was first successful. He must have been in his early... near to middle 30s, but he had been writing for many years.
All the time he was a Pinkerton man, he was writing?
No, not all the time, after he quit Pinkerton.
People you knew as writers, Fitzgerald, had very big successes at first, and I guess couldn't follow them up afterward.
Yes, he was quite young. Hemingway, I think, the first book was published, I think, in 1925, and he must have been a man 25 or 6 then. That's young, I think. I don't know of many writers now who have very great successes before that age. It's nicer to have it young, of course, but...
Not if you're forced to have to top yourself every time, I guess.
Well, there are other penalties for the other way around. I suppose if you don't have any kind of recognition, I'm not talking about money success, because that's something else, but if you don't have any recognition and get to be your 40s, things must be very... rather tough going. It must take a great deal more courage than it does if you get some recognition before then.
I never thought much about it. But if I had, I'd have known that you would die before I would. But I couldn't have known that you'd get heart trouble so early and so bad. I'm lucky, Horace. I've always been lucky. I'll be lucky again.
The Little Foxes was the most difficult play I ever wrote. I was clumsy in the first drafts, putting in and taking out characters, ornamenting, decorating, growing more and more weary as the versions of scenes, and then acts, and then 3 whole plays had to be thrown away. Some of the trouble came because the play has a distant connection to my mother's family, and everything I'd ever heard or seen or imagined had formed into a giant, tangled time jungle in which I could find no space to walk without tripping over old roots, hearing old voices speak about histories made long before my day. In the first 3 versions of the play, because it had been true in life, Horace Giddens had syphilis. When Regina, his wife, who had long refused him her bed, found out about it, she put fresh paint on a miserable building that had once been used as slave quarters and kept him there for the rest of his life because, she said, he might infect his children. I had been told that the real Regina would speak with outrage of her betrayal by a man she had never liked, and then would burst out laughing at what she said. On the day he died, she dropped the moral complaints forever and went horseback riding during his funeral. All that seemed fine for the play, but it wasn't. Life had been too big, too muddled for writing. So the syphilis became heart trouble. I cut out the slave cabin and long explanations of Regina and Horace's early life together.
Your family is incredible. You could have a few books on just your family. They really
Everybody's family's incredible.
Well, I don't know. But you speak of your grandmother as the type of person who... would break people's spirit for the exercise of it. It's a very strong lady. Mm-hmm. And you spoke of your feelings about your family's wealth, sort of a self-hated, your respect of the wealth, and I wondered if the little foxes purged you of this at all after you'd written it.
I think to a certain extent, yes. Yes, I think I wrote it out.
Yeah?
I think so. I've always thought I had.
I wondered if writing worked like that, like dreams, sort of, once you had gotten it down.
It very often does. I don't think you're ever finished really with anything that's the matter with you or even write about you, but you often can work out things that have been painful to you in writing, I think.
Hey, Ratty, your party was for?
Nothing for. I had the sweet butter, so I made the cake.
Isn't this nice? A party just for us.
Is Mama?
No, she ain't got back yet.
Sit down, David.
Not by me. I'm not speaking to him. He's too dull. He's always preaching.
Oh, well, it doesn't seem to affect your appetite. It
doesn't affect me in any way. I just ignore him.
Now, don't let anybody be bad friends. It's so nice here with just us. There, David. That's for you.
Thank you.
Elderberry's good for the stomach.
That's what Mama used to say. Mama used to give it to me when I was a little girl. For hiccups. You know, I don't think people get hiccups anymore. Isn't that funny?
No, and nobody gets growing pains no more. Just like there was some style in what you got. 1 year ailment stylish, and the next year taint. Miss Buddy, that elderberry wine going to give you a headache spell.
Oh, I don't think so. I remember now about the hiccups. It was my first big party, at Lionette, I mean, and there I was with hiccups and Mama laughing. Mama always laughed. A big party, a lovely dress from Mr. Worth in Paris, France, and hiccups. You know, that was the first day I ever saw Oscar Hubbard. We saw him from our window. He passed and lifted his hat, and my brother, to tease Mama, said Mama didn't like the Hubbards and wouldn't invite them to the party because they kept a store. And then I saw Mama angry for the first time in my life. She said that wasn't the reason. She said she just didn't like people who made their money charging awful interest to poor, ignorant colored folks and cheating them on what they bought. Well, she was very angry, Mama was. And then suddenly she laughed and said, look, I frightened Birdie out of her hiccups. And so she had. They were all gone.
Yes, they got mighty well off cheating the poor. Well, there's people that eats up the whole earth and all the people on it. Like in the Bible with the locusts. Then these people that stand round and watch them do it. Sometimes I think it ain't right to just stand and watch them do it.
There's something else in the Bible, Eddie. Take us the foxes. The little foxes that spoil the vines. For our vines have tender grapes.
Oh. If we could only go back to Lionette. Everybody'd be better there. They'd be good and kind. I like people to be kind. Don't you, Horace? Don't you like people to be kind?
Yes, Bertie, I do.
Yes. Yes, that was the first day I ever saw Oscar. Who would have thought?
Bertie.
Do you all want to know something? I don't like Leo. My very own son. And I don't like him. Isn't that funny, David? My, I guess I even like Oscar more than I like Leo.
Why did you marry Uncle Oscar?
That's no question for you to be asking.
Why not? As time she was asking questions. She's heard enough around here to ask anything.
Why did you, Aunt Bertie?
Well, I don't know. I thought I liked him, and he was so kind to me then, and I thought it was because he liked me, too. But that wasn't the reason. Ask why he married me. I can tell you that. He's told it to me often and not
Miss Birdie, though.
My family was good. That was part of it. But the cotton on Lionette's fields was better. Ben Hubbard wanted the cotton, and Oscar Hubbard married it for him. He was kind to me then. He used to smile at me. He hasn't smiled at me since. Well, everybody knew that's what he married me for. Everybody but me. Stupid, stupid.
You get talking like this, Miss Birdie, and you'll get a headache, sure.
I've never had a headache in my life. And you know it as well as I do. I've never had a headache, Sam. That's a lie they tell for me. I drink. All by myself, in my own room, by myself. I drink. And when they want to hide it, they say, Bertie's got a headache, Jan.
Oh, Aunt Bertie, don't.
You won't like me now. You won't like me anymore.
Love you alone.
Oh, don't. Don't love me. Because in 20 years, you'll just be like me. They'll do all the same things to you. And you'll trail after, just like me. Hoping they won't be so mean to you that day or say something to make you feel so bad. Only you'll be worse off because you won't have my mama to remember.
Bertie, don't. Come on now, we'll go home. Just you. Come on.
The Little Foxes is When You Met Tallulah. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your association with Tallulah, how she got involved with playing Regina in The Little Foxes.
Well, Herman Shonan thought of that casting.
He was the director, yeah.
Yes, director-producer. And I had never seen her, so I had no opinions at all. She turned out at first, as I've written many times, very, very, very good. And later on in the run of the play, not very good. But she certainly, when she served 6 months, was perfectly splendid.
The whole town loved and respected him.
Did you love Papa, Uncle Oscar?
Certainly, I... Why, what a strange thing to ask.
Did you love him, Uncle Ben?
Well, he had.
And you, Mama, did you love him, too?
I know what you feel, Alexandra, but please, dear, try to control yourself.
I'm trying, Mama. I'm trying very hard.
Grief makes some people laugh and some people cry. It's better to cry, Alexandra.
What was Papa doing on the staircase?
Please go and lie down, dear. We all need time to get over shocks like this. Please go, Alexandra.
No, Mama, I'll wait. I've got to talk to you.
Later, dear. Go and rest now.
I'll wait, Mama. I've plenty of time. All my life.
Well, as I was saying, tomorrow morning I'm going up to see Judge Sims. I shall tell him about Leo.
And what proof? What proof of all
None,
this?
I won't need any. The bonds are missing in there with Marshall. That'll be enough. If it isn't, I'll add what's necessary.
We'll deny...
Deny your heads off. You couldn't find a jury that wouldn't weep for a woman whose own brothers steal from her. And you couldn't find 12 men in this state you haven't cheated and who hate you for it.
How can you talk that way when upstairs not 5 minutes
There are
ago...
people who can never go back, who must finish what they start. I'm one of those people, Oscar. Where was I? Well, they'll convict you. I won't care much if they don't, because by that time you'll be ruined anyway. The deal will be off in an hour, and you know it. You will do no more bargaining in this house. I'll take my 75% and we'll forget the story forever. That's one way of doing it. And the way I prefer. You all know me well enough to know that I don't mind taking the other way.
Are you going to let her do this?
You have a suggestion?
No, he hasn't. All right. Well, Leo, I have forgotten that you ever saw the bond. And as long as you boys both behave yourselves, I've forgotten that we ever talked about him. You can draw up the necessary papers by tomorrow.
Come, Leo.
You're a good loser, Ben. I like that.
Well, I say to myself, what's the good? But I'm not discouraged. The century's turning. The world is open. Open for people like you and me. Ready for us. Waiting for us. We'll get along.
I think so.
Then, too, I say to myself, things may change. I agree with Alexandra. What is a man in a wheelchair doing on a staircase? I ask myself that.
And what do you answer?
I have no answer. But maybe someday I will. Maybe never, but maybe someday. When I do, I'll let you know.
When you do, write me. I'll be in Chicago. Ah, Ben. If Papa had only left me his money.
I'll see you tomorrow.
Oh, yes, certainly. You'll be sort of working for me now.
Alexandra, you're turning out to be a right interesting girl. Well, good night, all.
What do you want to talk to me about, Alexandra?
I've changed my mind. I don't want to talk. There's nothing to talk about now.
You're acting very strange, not like yourself. You've had a bad shock today, I know that. And you love Papa. But you must have expected this to come someday. You knew how sick he was.
I knew. We all knew.
It'll be good for you to get away from all this. Good for me, too. Time heals most wounds, Alexandra. You're young. You shall have all the things I wanted. I'll make the world for you the way I want it to be for me. We'll go in a few weeks. A few weeks. That means 2 or 3 Saturdays. 2 or 3 Sundays. I wonder what's the best place to stay.
Mama, I'm not coming with you. I'm not going to Chicago.
You're very upset, Alexandra.
I mean what I say, with all my heart.
We'll talk about it tomorrow. The morning will make a difference.
It won't make any difference, and there isn't anything to talk about. I'm going away from you because I want to. Because I know Papa would want me to.
You know your Papa would want you to go away from me?
Yes.
And if I say no?
Say it, Mama. Say it, and see what happens.
And if I make you stay?
That would be foolish. It wouldn't work in the end.
You're very serious about it, aren't you? Well, you'll change your mind in a few days.
You only change your mind when you want to. And I won't want to.
Alexandra, I've come to the end of my rope. Somewhere there's got to be what I want to. Life goes too fast. Do what you want. Think what you want. Go where you want. I'd like to keep you with me, but I won't make you stay. Too many people used to make me do too many things. No. I won't make you stay.
You couldn't, Mama, because I want to leave here, as I never wanted anything in my life before. Because now I understand what Papa was trying to tell me. Addie said there were people who ate the earth, and other people who stood around and watched him do it. And just now Uncle Ben said the same thing. Really, he said the same thing. Well, tell him for me, Mama. I'm not going to stand around and watch you do it. Tell him I'll be fighting just as hard as he'll be fighting. Someplace where people don't just stand around and watch.
Well, you have spirit after all. I used to think you were all sugar water. Well, we don't have to be bad friends, Alexandra. I don't want us to be bad friends. Would you like to come and talk to me, Alexandra? Would you like to sleep in my room tonight?
Are you afraid, Mama?
You adapted The Little Foxes to the screen. Was it difficult to do this, adapting a play for the screen? Was it hard to get into writing movies, especially adapting your own work?
No, I liked writing movies. I was one of the few people who sort of, in those days, genuinely enjoyed it. No, I liked it. I liked doing it.
Did you adapt The Children's Hour also?
The first Children's Hour was not The Children's Hour. We took the basic idea of the school and took the lesbianism out. It wasn't allowed. And it made a very nice little picture called These Three with Merle Oberon and Miriam Hopkins and Joel McRae. The second Children's Hour, which was done only about 8 or 9 years ago, I didn't have anything to do with. It was done by somebody else.
Did you like the way it showed up on screen?
Not entirely, no. I think perhaps Mr. Wyler was over-respectful of me. William Wyler, who had directed both pictures, was over-respectful of the play. And it would have been better to have altered it more in movie terms.
Can you give me some of the movies you wrote besides the things you adapted of yourself? The Searching Wind, I know you adapted for the screen. What else have you written?
I know you wrote The Chase, which you were disgusted with.
I did The Little Foxes. I did a first picture called Dark Angel. What else did I do? I did a picture called Dead End, Sidney Kingsley's play. Which is shown on television, still a great deal, I think. And then, of course, I also wrote what turned out to be a bad picture called North Star. And on North Star, Goldwyn and I had a fight. And then not long after that, of course, I was banned in Hollywood during the McCarthy days. And then when I wasn't banned anymore, I found I didn't very much want to work there.
You didn't want to go back?
No, not much.
Dashiell Hammett helped you the most, you say, with the little foxes.
Yes.
How did he help you? Just with his sharp criticism and...
Yes, sometimes real suggestions about what should happen, what shouldn't happen. Yes.
Did you work well together? I noticed he wrote the screenplay for Watch on the Rhine, and I was thinking it must be really hard to have somebody so close to you adapt one of your own works. Was it, or did you just work fantastically together?
Well, we didn't work together in the sense that you mean. He did Watch on the Rhine screenplay because I'd forgotten what I was doing and couldn't do it. He did it as a favor to me. He wasn't crazy about doing it. But we didn't work together in that sense. I mean, we read each other's stuff, but we didn't work in any kind of collaboration.
Did it work the other way also? Did you help him with suggestions and stuff on his?
No. Very seldom. Very seldom. He didn't want it, and I didn't offer it. I knew he didn't want it.
No. You must have had a huge amount of trust in him to allow him to adapt.
I had a great deal of trust in him, and it certainly was very difficult at times. I was very angry often. And he, in turn, I guess, must have been quite angry as well. But we worked it out. It was the kind of anger I got over and quickly saw that it was for my benefit. Sometimes I didn't agree with him, of course, and had to go my own way. But the criticism was always given without any malice, which is what one is frightened of it with in criticism of any kind, I think. Either malice or too much desire to please, which is almost just the same thing. And there was none of that, and I was grateful for the very professional help.
Yeah, I guess you had that.
Yes, he was a real pro behind everything else.
When we were very broke those first years in New York, Hammett got a modest advance from Knopf and began to write The Thin Man. He moved to what was jokingly called the Diplomat Suite in a hotel run by our friend Nathaniel West. It was a new hotel, but Pep West in the Depression had managed to run it down immediately. Certainly Hammett's suite had never seen a diplomat, because even the smallest Oriental could not have functioned well in the space. But the rent was cheap, and the awful food could be charged, and some part of my idle time could be spent with Pep snooping around the lives of the other rather strange guests. I'd known Dash when he was writing short stories, but I'd never been around for a long piece of work. Life changed. The drinking stopped. The parties were over. The locking in time had come, and nothing was allowed to disturb it until the book was finished. I'd never seen anybody work that way. The care for every word. The pride in the neatness of the typed page itself. The refusal for 10 days or 2 weeks to go out even for a walk for fear something would be lost. It was a good year for me, and I learned from it, and was perhaps frightened by a man who now did not need me. So it was a happy day when I was given half the manuscript to read, and was told that I was Nora. It was nice to be Nora, married to Nick Charles, maybe one of the few marriages in modern literature where the man and woman like each other and have a fine time together. But I was soon put back into place. Hammett said I was also the silly girl in the book, and the villainess.
How did you feel when he told you that Nora was based on you, Nora Charles?
Oh, I was very pleased. She's a charming character, I think.
She's swell, yes. It seems like the nicest character to be based on.
Yes, it is.
And they had a jolly life together.
Yes, they liked each other.
Oh, excuse me, lady.
Hello, Fingers.
Well, Nick, how are you?
How's business?
Oh, I quit that racket.
Nick, look. My purse is gone.
Oh, darling, isn't that too bad? Nora, I want you to know Fingers. This is my wife.
Your wife?
Mm-hmm.
See, I didn't know you were married.
Oh, yes, I'm married.
Nick, what do? I know I had it.
Oh, don't worry, Donnie. It'll turn up, won't it, Fingers?
Well, I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
Well, Nick, am I tickled to death to see you.
Yeah.
Good old Nick. And married, too. I didn't know you were married.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm glad I bumped into you. Well, goodbye, Mr. Charles.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Fingers. Come on, dear.
Well, darling, I can't just go off.
Come on, we don't want to embarrass him.
What are you talking about?
He's a purse snatcher. Think of his feelings.
Well, then he must have taken it.
So long, Fingers.
So long, Nick.
There you are, dear.
Dear, you do know the night.
you went back to Russia several times, but this first time you went, the Russian State Department, for some reason, chose you to go to the front line. They called you into their office and said you were allowed to meet anybody in Moscow that you wanted.
Yes.
And you couldn't quite understand why they had chosen you.
Well, no, that isn't quite the way it was. I was a guest, and I had refused to go as a journalist because I realized that as a guest, in a sense, I would be far better off. I'd be allowed to see more. I did do pieces, but I did them when I came home. But journalists were very restricted, and I knew that before I went, realized that I'd be less restricted. I was right, because I was the only person ever allowed to go to the Russian front.
That sounds incredible. It really does. I mean, I guess that is the closest you've been to war. I mean, I guess you were closer there than you were during the Spanish Civil War, although
yes,
you were in Spain.
I think so. I think so.
Lillian Hellman was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee to name names of associates and friends in the theater who might have communist associations. She declined, but did submit a letter to the court. Here is Hellman reading her letter.
I am under subpoena to appear before your committee on May 21st, 1952. I am willing to answer all questions about myself. I have nothing to hide from your committee, and there's nothing in my life of which I am ashamed. I am ready and willing to testify to my own opinions and my own actions, regardless of any risks or consequences to myself. I am not willing, now or in the future, to bring bad trouble to people who in my past association with them were completely innocent of any talk or any action that was disloyal or subversive. I don't like subversion or disloyalty, and if I'd ever seen any, I would have considered it my duty to have reported it to the proper authorities. But to hurt innocent people in order to save myself is to me inhuman, indecent, dishonorable. I cannot and I will not cut my conscience to fit this year's fashions. I am prepared to waive the privilege against self-incrimination and to tell you anything you wish to know about my views or actions if your committee will agree to refrain from asking me about other people. But if the committee is unwilling to give me this assurance, I will be forced to plead the privilege of the Fifth Amendment. I await your reply. Sincerely yours, Lillian Hellman.
The infamous House Un-American Activities Committee refused her request. Lillian Hellman took the Fifth Amendment and was blacklisted.